Iraq's Last Chance, today, Friday, August 22nd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The pressure mounts on a new Iraqi leader to find a way to unite his country's factions. This longtime Iraqi advisor to Washington says it's a tall order.
The Iraqi social fabric has basically been shredded, and it's a spiral that's very difficult to stop.
Also today, we get answers to some basic questions about the two American Ebola patients discharged this week.
They do not have the Ebola virus in them anymore, and they're of no danger to society, to their family, or to the people who come into contact with them.
Plus, it's been 70 years since a U.S. bomber crashed into her school in England, but Ruby Curl still remembers.
I woke up at night and saw this airman at the side of my bed, and I found out afterwards he was the airman that had pulled me out.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. It's not that I was expecting good news from Gaza today. Even so, I've been taken aback by some of the latest news from the Mideast, like the shocking execution by Hamas of several suspected informers working for Israel. These were Palestinians suspected of passing information over to the Israeli military. 11 were killed secretly by a firing squad. 7 were dragged behind a mosque and shot in public, gangland style. The executions came after 3 top Hamas commanders were killed by an Israeli airstrike. Reporter Daniel Estrin is in Jerusalem, and he says not much is known about those who were executed.
Well, we really don't have any idea who these people actually are who were killed. They could have been people already in Hamas jails who were suspected of spying for Israel and just brought out and killed. Hamas has also imprisoned, tortured members of the rival Palestinian party Fatah in the past. So Hamas itself says they're not releasing the names of these people because they don't want retribution on their families. But I think their actual identities aren't as important as the message that Hamas is putting out. This is the punishment for helping Israel.
How much does Israel rely on Palestinian informants on the ground, like in Gaza specifically? Is this a big network?
I don't have any information on how big the network is. I told this a former official that the Gaza officials had said that about 30 Palestinians had previously been killed. He said that number, 30, would be considered a very big number in terms of the network of recruits inside Gaza. Recruiting informants in Gaza is harder for Israel than it is to recruit them in the West Bank, where Israel maintains a military occupation, because Gaza is pretty much sealed off and there's no Israeli presence inside Gaza.
For the people who live inside Gaza, I mean, these executions were of people they know, presumably. What kind of criticism inside Gaza has there been to these killings?
Well, today we did hear from the main Palestinian human rights organization in Gaza. They put out a statement criticizing it. They called it extrajudicial execution. The group also said that 2 women were among those who were executed by the firing squad.
Is that rare?
We have not heard of other women executed in the past, so I think it is rare.
And at the same time, you've got basically a crowd of people watching these executions take place. Something seems disconnected here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is, first of all, Hamas is trying to put out this message to people that we are doing this not in secret, not by a secret firing squad, but now we are doing this in public, and the message is clear to everyone, but it certainly is a scary thing.
Yeah, and the way you describe it, it may inhibit people inside Gaza from working as informants for Israel, but it might not necessarily stop the executions.
Correct. And it's especially interesting and important to note the timing of this. These executions today happened a day after Israel targeted and killed 3 Hamas commanders, top commanders, as you had said. It was a huge embarrassment to Hamas, and it demonstrated just how deep Israeli intelligence has penetrated this organization, which usually operates in the shadows. And so the message is extremely clear here that Hamas will not tolerate this kind of thing again.
Just finally, Daniel, these 3 Al-Qassam Brigade commanders in Hamas, they were high up in kind of a critical mass of military sophistication. What does this do now to Hamas and their fight against Israel?
This has really shaken Hamas. Their commanders do not walk around openly in Gaza. Especially during this war, they have gone completely underground. And because commanders' movements are only known by a select few within the organization, the suspicion is that there's a mole inside Hamas. And so I think that really has Hamas jittery right now. In terms of their ability to fight, it doesn't appear to stop their ability to fire rockets. Today, there were scores of rockets fired at Israel. Some Israeli commentators here, though, are saying that it's going to be hard for Hamas to find and train good replacements for these top commanders who were killed. So that will impact the group's military abilities.
Reporter Daniel Estrin speaking with us from Jerusalem. The decades-old Israeli-Palestinian conflict feels intractable, and now Iraq is starting to have that same quality. 3 years after the U.S. withdrawal, American fighter jets are back now, bombing targets in Iraq on a daily basis. This time it's to help the Shiite-dominated Iraqi government fight the advancing Sunni militants known as the Islamic State, or ISIS. And that threatens to split Iraq apart along sectarian lines. But after years under the divisive former leader Nouri al-Maliki, there's a new prime minister, Haider al-Abadi, and he's trying to form a more inclusive government. Ali Kaderi helped in the formation of the last five Iraqi governments. He was a special assistant to U.S. ambassadors in Iraq from 2003 to 2010. And Kaderi recently wrote an item in the New York Times saying this is Iraq's last chance. I asked him to explain that.
Basically, the Iraqi people are getting very close to deciding that they can't live with one another. And if that occurs, if Prime Minister-designate Abadi fails to form an inclusive cabinet that can unite Iraqis, then really what we'll see is a very long, bloody partition of Iraq as the three communities go their separate ways.
Right, which isn't very clear how to keep it together. I mean, the Islamic State has all these gains in the north. There's political fighting in Baghdad. What does Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi actually need to do to prevent some all-out civil war, the country getting balkanized?
Frankly, he needs to produce a miracle because primarily of Prime Minister Maliki's misrule, but also because of 30 years of misrule by Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party. What's happened is the Iraqi social fabric has basically been shredded. And the three major communities, the Sunni Arabs, the Shia Arabs, and the Kurds, have become increasingly polarized. And so the Shia Arabs have primarily become Islamists now and have for decades received hundreds of millions of dollars of support from Iranian intelligence services. And in the case of the Sunnis since 2003, many of them who were sort of allied with the Ba'ath Party have increasingly been allied with, let's say, ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And so as everybody goes to the corners and wages more and more bloodbaths against each other, essentially, that has begun a spiral downwards, and it's a spiral that's very difficult to stop.
Is Abadi a natural uniter, and is it too much of a task for one person?
It's definitely too much of a task for one person. Even if you were to drop Nelson Mandela himself into Baghdad, you know, he would not be able to do it alone. And that's why I think that the Shia Alliance's nomination of Haider al-Abadi as prime minister designate is a great first step, but he faces a Herculean task in really uniting the country, in telling his fellow Shia Islamists that they should let bygones be bygones and maybe begin to forgive some of the Ba'athist crimes against them. And then it is incumbent on the Sunnis to begin to share power with the Shia Islamists, who they distrust, particularly after a long and very violent war with Iran in the 1980s. And then it's incumbent on the Kurds in the north, who will have an entirely different language and an entirely different ethnicity from the rest of Arab Iraq, to give Iraq one last chance.
Could the Kurds just say, we don't need Baghdad?
Well, the Kurds are increasingly, since 1991 and since 2003, are increasingly saying that. And the reason why, frankly, is perfectly understandable. The Kurds say, look, you know, under both Sunni Arabs and Shia Arabs, we have been persecuted. We've faced chemical weapons attacks. You know, 200,000 people of our killed in a genocide campaign under Saddam Hussein. And then now under Maliki, you know, he is refusing to grant us our portion of the nation's oil wealth, which we are entitled to under Iraq's constitution. So the question now is, will Prime Minister-designate Abadi and his new cabinet be successful in turning a page, doing business in a new way, uniting Iraqis under a nationalist banner, rather than doing what both Saddam and Maliki did, which is use the country's vast oil wealth as a weapon to abuse the country's citizens? And we'll just have to wait and see.
Ali Kaderi was special assistant to five American ambassadors in Iraq from 2003 to 2010. He spoke with us from Dubai. Another thing about Iraq, it's a very young country. More than half of all Iraqis are under the age of 20, and all the violence and instability means fewer opportunities for them. Many are choosing to leave Iraq, but reporter Susanna George tracked down one group of young Iraqi men who are determined to break that trend.
Outside is a typical Baghdad street, dusty, garbage-strewn. One end is blocked off by a barbed wire checkpoint. Inside is worlds away. This small cafe is crammed full of books and antiques. Being here feels like walking back in time. And that's exactly why this group of young men like it here.
Because when I read in the history of Iraq, like, for example, the education and the libraries and the lifestyle of Baghdad in the 70s, I was jealous, actually.
That's Ali Mahzoumi. He and his five friends, all in their 20s, smoking water pipes and drinking sodas, say that this is the Iraq they're trying to recreate, a country that's highly educated, tolerant, safe, and most of all, one that promises young people a future. But while these guys are here in Baghdad now, they're the exception to the rule. Almost all of their friends, well-educated, young, ambitious Iraqis who can travel, they've all left to build a life abroad.
It's good for the individual. He will build his future. But in general, as my perspective or my opinion, it's selfish a little bit to leave Iraq.
Ali, who works for a local NGO in Baghdad that promotes education, says it's important for young Iraqis to stay, to counter extremism and corruption. This is a tight crew. They see each other a lot, and they talk a lot about
everything. Politics, football, girls.
Lately, the events unfolding in Mosul, just a few hours' drive north of here, dominate the conversation. But these guys say no matter what's in the headlines, talk always comes back to what they see as the source of all Iraq's ills, government corruption.
The government, they have to forget about corruption now. But they can't, unfortunately, yeah.
Did you say it's in their blood?
Nowadays, yeah. After 20 years, they're used to it. That's not genetic, like... It's like when you get addictive to like alcohol or something, or even like weed or whatever, it's just like you're used to it. They're used to corruption nowadays. They're used to it.
That's Ali Abawi, a university student. Despite all the violence, universities in Iraq are still open. These young men say it's the violence, the corruption, and the general instability that drives most of their friends to leave.
I'm one of the people who went on a scholarship, and then I came back after graduation. And my mom is hating me more and more.
That's Haider Shakri, a bit off mic there. What he's saying is that the person pressuring him the most to leave is his mother. His parents and their whole generation, Haider says, they're done with Iraq. They say it's doomed, that the country is finished. And Ali Mahzoumi says he gets it. With Iraq's violent past, it's easy to lose hope.
Yeah, I was born in war, I grew up with another war, and I live now with a new war. So,
What makes you different from your parents?
My parents, maybe they educated me in a different way.
From a young age, he's always read history, and he's seen that in Iraq's past, the country's gone through difficult times and recovered. That, he says, is what gives him hope for the future and what makes him want to stay. Then Ali Abawi chimes in.
The only thing is different now, and like our generation is more exposed to the world, to the outer world.
We got more opportunities than them, maybe.
Most of the young guys here can't quite explain why they're hopeful amid such hopelessness. Some say they can't imagine being any other way. Others say they like the challenge. Leaving would be the easy way out. Ali Mahzoumi says he knows that staying in Iraq doesn't ensure that anything will change, but it's a start.
I hope. I mean, we don't have the power. We are not the decision makers, but... We will do, and we are doing, actually, what we can do. And that's it.
For The World, I'm Susanna George in Baghdad.
Still ahead on The World, Mexican music legends in the stars on PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. With all the conflicts around the globe, it's often the pictures of the injured children that get me. I wonder if they survive what they'll remember years later of the violence they experienced in their childhood. Our partners at the BBC recently spoke with someone who, as a child, survived a horrible World War II tragedy. Ruby Currell is her name. I heard her story earlier today, and it moved me so much I had to share it with you. So here's that story from BBC reporter Simon Watts about what happened to Ruby and her town in England on August 23, 1944.
In August 1944, life in Freckleton on the northwest coast of England was dominated by the huge American airbase nearby. The villagers all remember the generosity of the US personnel stationed there.
My mum used to take in washing, like lots of people. It was funny because they say, careful with that, Ma. That meant there was something in the parcel. Might have been a tin of corned beef, or it might have been a tin of fruit or whatever.
Ruby Currell was a little girl during the war. The American base was so close to Freckleton that the runway backed onto the primary school that little Ruby and her friends went to. August the 23rd was the third day of the new term, and Ruby, then just five, remembers not wanting to go back.
It was a beautiful day, and it would have been nicer to be playing.
But within an hour, that beautiful day had disappeared. Freckleton was hit by a freak storm, the worst in living memory, as an older pupil, Harry Latham, recalled for Radio Lancashire.
There was winds and there was rain, and it was a horrible-looking sky, very frightening, and all the time we felt that something was going to happen.
There was thunderbolts all over the place, and then crash, bang, wallop.
The crash was the sound of an American Air Force plane hitting Freckleton. After takeoff, the pilot had tried desperately to turn back in the storm, but came down a few hundred metres short of the base. The infants class at Holy Trinity Primary took a direct hit from part of the B-24, and the village was engulfed in flames.
The whole area was flooded with the floodwater from the rain, and the kerosene from all the engines, or engines, had set alight, and the whole place was ablaze. There was also a gateway that led to what we call our playing field, and a high east wall. By this time, the Americans had come from Site 12. They'd got themselves on either side of the wall, and they were throwing pupils, including myself, over this wall, which seemed like a mountain in those days. But we didn't know someone at the other side was catching, you see. So that's a vivid memory of being thrown over a wall and luckily being caught at the other side.
Harry Latham was lucky. He and the older children all managed to escape from the inferno. But the infants' classroom, where Ruby was, collapsed in a heap of rubble.
I saw a girl fall out of a desk, and my instinct was to get under the desk so that I didn't fall. And that's when, a little while after, in the doorway, there was just enough for two heads to be seen. One was the headmaster, Mr. Billington, and the other was an American airman. And they were beckoning me to come out. Now, I wasn't going to go anywhere for anybody. The American airman scrambled in and picked me up, wrapped me in a blanket and took me and put me in on this stretcher. And I was yelling for all England. And that's when they gave me a shot in the arm and shut me up.
Ruby was taken to the hospital at the American base.
I woke up at night and saw this airman at the side of my bed, and he was there most nights. And I found out afterwards he was the airman that had pulled me out, and he wanted to be there to see that I was going to stay alive.
With severe burns on her arms and legs, Ruby was bandaged up until she looked like an Egyptian mummy, as she puts it. 38 schoolchildren were killed in the disaster, all under the age of 7. 23 adults also died, including British and American servicemen and civilians. At the time, though, the crash wasn't widely reported, partly because it happened on the same day as the liberation of Paris, and partly because of concerns it might stir anti-American feeling in Britain. But in early September, one of the biggest stars in the world visited Freckleton.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
And after entertaining the troops, he went in to see Ruby and the two other injured children.
Bing Crosby came to the hospital and he came in to see us. And he shook hands with, well, best way he could, fingertips. And he wanted to know if I wanted him to sing and what did I want him to sing. And I said, "Don't fence me in and White Christmas." But he couldn't sing in the room where we were. He went out into the hallway and sung.
Because he was too upset by singing
these two. He couldn't manage to do it where we were. But he sung to us. He still sung to us out in the passage.
Ruby Currell spent nearly 2 years in hospital recovering from her injuries. It was only then that she was told she'd lost so many school friends in the crash.
I was taken to see where the children were buried. That's when it came home.
And it must have been incredibly hard then to grow up here and in the years that followed.
It used to be difficult for some of the mums. And I know I had one lady who used to cry every time she saw me. Another lady always used to come and give me a hug. And, all right, sometimes, how can I put it? I didn't really want to avoid them, but it was just sometimes I needed to avoid them because it upset me as well as them. And it still does sometimes.
Now in her 70s, Ruby Currell has recently moved back to Freckleton, coming home to roost, as she calls it. She's never blamed the Americans for the crash that killed her schoolmates and often visits the US to see the many service families there who've become her friends.
Amazing story there from the BBC's Simon Watts. Now, this next note is about something completely different, as they say, but it also involves telling amazing stories, only through music. Me gusta andar por la sierra. Music from the borderlands of northern Mexico and Texas, norteño, all seems to go umpapa. But these guys here, they stand alone at the top of the norteño mountain, and even Hollywood has confirmed it. Los Tigres del Norte, the Tigers of the North. The Hernandez brothers and their cousin began singing together around the same time that the Beatles were breaking up, the late 60s. They're based in California, by the way, but they've long written and sung norteño ballads about life in Mexico and the borderlands. They tackle everything from the drug war to presidential politics to immigration, and of course, that old time-tested theme of love. Yesterday, Los Tigres del Norte were awarded their own star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So from the dusty backroad performance tents of northern Mexico to Hollywood Boulevard and the entertainment mainstream, here's to you, you Tigers. This is PRI. We'll be right back. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, the daughter of African immigrants and what we can learn from the unrest in Ferguson.
I think of the legacy of Ferguson as one of collective resistance, right? Of talking back to the state and of recognizing that Black bodies are worthy of life and that we matter and that we have a right to assert that.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's been a week of mixed news on Ebola, from a riot in Liberia's capital as police there tried to quarantine an entire neighborhood, to two American patients released from an Atlanta hospital after apparently beating the deadly virus. Both U.S. patients received an experimental drug, ZMapp, and are now back home with their loved ones. So one step forward here, but not in West Africa, where more than 1,400 people have died from this Ebola outbreak, according to the World Health Organization. I still have a lot of questions about this disease, as I'm sure you do, so I put some of them to one of America's leading experts on infectious diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, over at the National Institutes of Health. First, I asked him for an update on the two Americans.
They do not have the Ebola virus in them anymore, and they're of no danger to society, to their family, or to the people who come into contact with them.
In lay terms, tell us physically what happened in their bodies to get rid of the Ebola virus.
There's a lot of publicity around the fact that they were brought here from Liberia and were given an experimental therapeutic, which is really a cocktail of antibodies, which are proteins that the body generally makes, but these were artificially produced. We really cannot tell whether the specific therapy that they received made any difference in their clinical course, and there's a lot of misinformation about that. We just don't know. We don't know if it had no effect, if it had a good effect, or if, in fact, it could have paradoxically even delayed their recovery. The important thing is that both of the Americans got into very good first-class medical care at Emory, and that probably contributed more than anything else to their recovery. So we're very gratified that they recovered, but remember, 50-plus percent approximately of people recover anyway. If you look at the case fatality rate in the West African countries, it's about 57, 56%. So close to 50% of people will recover. The better the care, the more chances you have of recovering.
Are you saying they could have recovered without taking ZMapp?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that, that they could have recovered. And we don't know. We hope that the ZMapp made an impact, but we don't know. It should be pointed out that ZMapp was also given to a Spanish priest who was AeroVac'd from West Africa back to Spain, and he died despite good medical care. So it is just too early now, with so few people having been treated with ZMapp, to make any definitive statement as to whether or not it works.
Do you think maybe the Ebola virus was killed inside their bodies by natural antibodies or something
like that? Oh, absolutely. That's what happens with the almost 50% of the people who do recover. The critical issue that we all keep emphasizing is that good medical care, namely getting people under the care of a good health care providers with the predominant intervention being replacement of fluids, they get fluid depleted because of diarrhea, vomiting, and even some bleeding. And the life-saving therapies are really replacement of fluid by intravenous being the predominant way of doing that. And if you can do that and keep people alive, the natural immune system that the body generates against the virus ultimately clears the virus. So for the people who did not get ZMapp, which is virtually everybody except a very, very small few, the ones who recovered, recovered because their body ultimately eliminated the virus by their own immune response.
So it sounds like they won't have to take ZMapp anymore, right?
Oh, of course not. No, once they're better and they're virus-free, they just need to recover from a serious illness in the sense of, you know, I'm sure it wore them down terribly, despite the fact that Dr. Brantley at the press conference looked rather good on TV. But going through an Ebola infection is not something you take lightly, and I'm sure it'll take some time to fully recover.
How do you really know, though, that the virus is gone once, you know, it's been seemingly defeated?
We have very, very sensitive molecular probes that probe for the virus in the blood. When people have the virus in them, it readily spills over into the blood. And you could examine blood, stool, urine, a variety of body fluids. You don't find the virus. So when the virus is cleared and the body's immune system essentially takes over, it protects you against that particular strain of Ebola, which in this case is referred to as the Zaire strain of Ebola.
Now, Dr. Brantley and Nancy Reitbold, is it possible they could get sick again? I mean, is Ebola like chickenpox or Lyme disease, which can hide for years and later reemerge as shingles?
It is highly likely, based on animal data, highly likely that they are protected against re-exposure to the particular strain that they were infected with. However, there are about five separate strains. So if they get exposed to the Zaire strain, it is highly, highly likely that they will be protected against getting reinfected.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, thanks very much for your time.
Good to be with you.
Summertime in the streets of big cities means you're likely to come across one specific group of people, street performers. From London to Paris to Shanghai, if there's foot traffic, you're going to find them. The world's Shirin Jafari spotted one not very far from our studios here in Boston, and she spent some time with him.
I want to take you to a place I visit a lot, Harvard Square. It's near where I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. If you've been here, you already know that as the summer sun hits the sidewalks, so do the street performers. They come from all over the country, even the world. That music is not Paris, right here. Lately, though, I've noticed a new face. He stands out because every time I pass by, there's a lot of people surrounding him.
You guys want to come up to the line? I'll do a little warm-up trick for you. I do a little card trick to warm my hands up, then I do the actual show.
He's small, maybe 5 foot something, and he wears a fedora, shorts, and a vest.
The first point of coin magic is that you can't trust your eyes, you see. If you believe everything your eyes tell you, you'll believe a lot of stuff in the world that just isn't true.
This guy makes cards disappear and end up in his shoe, makes rubber balls vanish, then takes them out of his mouth. He balances coins on the tip of his fingers, making the shape of a flower. His tricks are the best I've ever seen a street performer do. Seriously. He's 22 years old, and his name is Makoto.
I actually like the meaning of my name. I lie for money, you know. Magicians are inherently deceptive, and my name means honesty, so it's a neat name to have.
Makoto wouldn't be a magician if it wasn't for one important event in his life. In fact, he would not even be here in the U.S.
I was born in Japan, and I was in an orphanage almost immediately because my biological mother had a mental disorder that made it impossible for her to care for me.
When he was 2 years old, a couple adopted Makoto, and they brought him here to the U.S. He grew up in California. Makoto's adoptive mother is from Japan, and one thing both parents wanted was for him to get to know the place he was born and his culture. So, every summer, he would go back to Japan for summer camp.
It really was a culture shock. The kids there, you know, and they wore, you know, well-fitted uniforms, you know, white shirts and shorts for the guys and I think dresses for the girls. And I was there in jeans and a big baggy t-shirt, very, you know, suburban Californian.
Makoto says he doesn't know what his life would be like if he never left Japan. But he says he probably wouldn't be a magician. From his experience, the Japanese don't really connect all that well with street magicians. He tried performing there, but most people didn't stop to watch. Only the police did. That's because he didn't have a permit.
And the guy came up to me, and I remember I made sure to only speak English. You know, I said, oh, sorry, I don't really know Japanese too well. I'm Californian. I know I look at Japanese, but I only know English. And one of the cops said, oh, that's fine. I know English as well. I studied it in California. And I was like, ah, goddammit.
That's not like his experience in South Korea.
A friend of mine said that in Korea, if they see someone who looks like he's doing something, they assume he's famous and they stop and watch. And so my whole show was about 5 minutes long of just doing, you know, sort of visual stuff. And I had 40, 50 people watching me back-to-back shows, and I think I made about $70 an hour.
But back here in Cambridge, once you see the expressions on the faces of the people watching him, it's difficult to imagine Makoto doing something else.
That's a tennis ball. my show, guys.
Thank you.
As fall approaches, the street performers here disperse. Makoto is back home finishing up his studies at University of California, Riverside. He's a creative writing major there. His parents, he says he likes to think they're happy for him.
They grew up in a time when a big house, a kid and a dog and green grass was sort of the goal for everyone. And they've accepted that that's not my goal.
His goal is to come up with more of his own tricks and one day make a big name for himself. So next time you're here in the summer, look for the guy with fedora and shorts with a lot of people around him. He might not be performing on the sidewalk for long. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The unrest this month in Ferguson, Missouri, has many Americans, myself included, thinking about where we are as a country when it comes to race. And each perspective on that story is shaped by each person's unique narrative. Take Hannah Georgis. She's an Ethiopian-American writer in New York, and she wrote about what she's feeling recently for the Guardian newspaper, saying in part that African immigrants must be Ferguson strong.
You know, when I think about what that means to me, it's the idea of being in solidarity with other Black people in the U.S., whether that's people who identify as African-American or other African immigrants such as ourselves, and people who are immigrants from other places in the African diaspora. It's the idea of understanding that there's something really important happening right now that does concern us.
So what prompted you to write this in the first place, Hannah?
I mean, a number of things. I've been sort of wrapped up in the idea that this could be either one of my brothers, that this hits very close to home. And I've seen, you know, a bit of apathy amongst other African immigrants whom I know. And I kind of started to think about why that might be. And a lot of it has to do with where we situate ourselves in the context of U.S. identity.
Yeah, explain that. What do you mean situate yourselves? And why does that kind of situation then kind of lead to apathy?
Sure. So I think that when you immigrate to the United States, there's sort of this race to achieve the American dream, right? It's you're sold a lot of images about prosperity and about, you know, becoming the right kind of American. And the right kind of American isn't Black. And you find that out sort of before you come here, whether it's through American media that has sort of all sorts of stereotypes about African American people, or whether it's just through everyday interaction where people sort of subtly or directly encourage you not to identify with Blackness. And so I've seen people shift away from wanting to identify with African American people as both a survival tactic and as a way to assimilate into the, you know, quote unquote, perfect American identity.
Right. Your father emigrated to the U.S. from Yes. Ethiopia in the early 1980s. So do you and he see the racial tension of Ferguson differently?
Yeah, absolutely. Both my father and my mother are sort of more apt to believe the narrative around Mike Brown having stolen something and maybe he was a threat and, you know, maybe the police officer genuinely feared for his life. And I think that some of that stems from like a really earnest desire to want to believe that this country to which they've immigrated is as honest as it makes itself out to be. And for me, having grown up here, I see a different side of that.
Activists and academics will make the point that African Americans have, you know, the historical tragedy of slavery and the struggles that followed hundreds of years of being treated like animals and that this country is still wrestling with that. Does your father accept that?
I think that he does in a sort of abstract, theoretical way. What's different is that that doesn't feel personal for him. And he doesn't necessarily feel that people read that struggle and that legacy onto his body every day. Whereas I think for me, I feel people reading that struggle onto my body, regardless of whether or not it's actually true to my personal heritage. And so there's a way that I have to grapple with it.
What do you think the legacy of Ferguson is going to be?
I think of the legacy of Ferguson as one of collective resistance, right? Of talking back to the state and of recognizing that Black bodies are worthy of life and that we matter and that regardless of what the state and the media say, that we have a right to assert that and a right to mourn and a right to feel and grieve in the way that all other humans can.
It's interesting. I mean, the kind of police presence, that authoritarian presence in Ferguson, I imagine that may have been kind of the same muscle that your father was fleeing from in Ethiopia.
Absolutely, which is why I don't think it's impossible to sort of make these links or forge solidarity when you think about the fact that a lot of folks who immigrated here left at times when there was heavy policing, heavy militarization, My mom tells stories of times when the government would kill people for suspicion of treason and then charge their families for the bullets. Mm. And so when you think about the ways that our lives are just seen as not valuable and as collateral damage, I think that there's a lot of connection there and a way that we could understand that trauma keeps us apart, but it could also be the thing that we rally around.
Hannah Georgis is, according to her Twitter feed, an Ethiopian-American writer, organizer, artist, and awkward black girl trying to make sense of diaspora. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what do the protests in Ferguson mean for immigrant communities here in the U.S.? We're talking about that right now on Facebook. Just search for our group called the Global Nation Exchange and join in on the discussion.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. I can't remember a summer of news like this in a while. Gaza, Iraq, Ukraine, Syria, Ebola, Ferguson. Stories that don't make you smile. But that doesn't mean we want to stop covering everything else. We take on the full range of human life out there. So let's do something now that we should have done a few months ago. Bring you some of the great summer music that our show director April Peavy and I are excited about. April, it's been a pretty good summer for music. What have you been listening to?
Hi, Marco. And first of all, where did the summer go?
I know.
I just can't believe it.
Time flies.
But I will say that despite all the news, I've had a lot of fun listening to a lot of great music that came out this summer. And let me share with you my first pick. It's disco music from the Caribbean. A compilation came out this summer called Tropical Disco Hustle, and it's great grooves from the 70s and 80s. The track I want to share with you is a group called Wildfire. The song is called The Rebels.
Feel the disco throb, but it's funny. They can't kind of let reggae go.
Right, exactly. The song came out in the 80s, and it's all about corruption, and I guess in Trinidad and Tobago, there was a lot of unemployment among the youth, so this was a song about rising against the government at that time.
Wildfire is the band with a 70s disco-inspired track called The Rebels from Trinidad and Tobago. Who knew? I saw that come in. I did not know what was inside. I'm going to check it out now.
It's really great. What's your first pick, Marco?
April, I have really been digging this album called No Deal by a Belgian singer named Melanie Di Biasio. And it's just come out in the U.S. this summer. This is kind of the whole album slightly darkish in tone. But I don't think of Di Biasio as kind of a scary singer. She's more like a Dusty Springfield from the lowlands who every day is a gray day. This is a track, The Flow.
What's that look upon your face? It seems you've got a lot to say. But no words come. The flow seems to be gone. Let's sing the way through it. How about a new way to pray?
I received the CD as well, and I'll have to definitely listen to it more carefully. I listened to it once, and yeah, I need to go back.
So what's your second pick, April?
My second pick is a beautiful collaboration, a father and son collaboration between Tumani and Siddiqui Diabate. They both are from Mali. They play kora. The track I want to play for you is a beautiful melody. It's track number 3, Rashid Wagini. Here's father and son, each of them on the kora.
This is wonderful.
Yeah, it's
I need really, to get back into this album.
Really beautiful.
You know, April, you direct the World program, which means that when the World does the actual broadcast, you're the one on the other side of the glass who cues me to talk. You also select the music that goes in between segments. Any of your summer selections made it on air already as what we call cutaways?
In fact, the song that we just heard by Tumani and Siddiqui, I have played that occasionally as a cutaway.
I thought I'd heard that before.
Yeah.
All right, my next pick, April, is from a little band, actually not a little band, a fairly large band from Ottawa called the Soul Jazz Orchestra. This album, Inner Fire, came out this summer. And this track, Kingdom Come, has an Ethiopian jazz funk groove, but the Soul Jazz Orchestra is so much more than just African grooves. Always seriously funky, though. They're very busy on the road. They've been out on the road this summer. Here's Kingdom Come.
So when was this recorded, Marco? It sounds like it was recorded in the 50s or 60s.
It's a new album. It came out this year. And actually, the Soul Jazz Orchestra has kind of a dedicated analog recording studio. So maybe that's what you're hearing. It's just kind of raw, and they're recording as a band, not as, you know, overdubs.
Wow. Fantastic.
So that's the Soul Jazz Orchestra from their CD Inner Fire and a track called Kingdom Come. What's your final pick, April?
It's by Jorge Drexler, the doctor from Uruguay.
Right.
A lot of other listeners may know him for composing the soundtrack to Motorcycle Diaries that came out several years ago. It's a wonderful collaboration where he has a lot of guest artists come in to perform the vocals. Ana Tijoux from Chile, the Colombian group Bomba Estéreo, the lead singer from that group. And one of my favorite singers is Caetano Veloso from Brazil. Here he is playing the song called Bolivia.
Años de guerra caliente, varios años antes de la guerra fría. Todos decían que no. Cuando dijo que sí, Bolivia.
And apparently this song has very special meaning to Jorge Drexler. It's about his father and grandfather who left Germany in 1939 and moved to Bolivia.
German Jews who were playing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Y aquel niño en los brazos de mis abuelos.
So that's a song called Bolivia from Jorge Drexler's latest CD. It's called Bailar en la Cueva, Dancing in the Cave.
It's funny you picked a song with Caetano Veloso on vocals, because my final pick is also from Brazil. It goes back a number of years, though. This is an album called Siria. It's a wild kind of punk rock hybrid street music, a mix that goes back to the intermarriage of slaves of African origin and the natives of the Amazon rainforest. So really wild hybrid. Mestre Cupijo was the musician, a very smart and curious musician, born in Brazil in 1936 to a family of musicians. But he also had this Alan Lomax streak and went to live in these rainforest settlements with these maroon mixed race people and learn their music. Then he comes back to the city, arranges it for jazz big band, and in the 1970s they score a bunch of big hits across Brazil, like this one called Cabo Clinha do Igapo.
So, Cabo Clinha do Igapo, moro.
You know, April, I got to tell you, I loved your picks, and it's a reminder to dig back into my piles of CDs and see what else I've missed this summer.
Likewise.
Great. Always great to talk with you. I'm glad we did this, even if it's a couple of months late.
Thanks, Marco.
The World's April Peavy there, who also happens to be our show director. We want to hear from you, too. What's on your summer soundtrack? You can let us know what you've been listening to at PRI.org. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. You guys have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor. The PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.